This week, the Dow Jones Industrials blasted higher for the sixth week in a row, closing at yet another all-time high within earshot of the 16,000 mark. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, with you. Well, we have what could be the biggest show of 2013 in store for you on this November 15th broadcast. Champion of personal freedoms, Dr. Ron Paul, joins me for a discussion on the economy and the precious metals sector. Dr. Paul says that government spending is, well, out of control, making gold and silver must-hold assets. Jim Rogers concurs. He's particularly worried about fiat currencies and social unrest. Then Michael Maloney and I discuss the merits of gold ownership. His research shows that all paper money schemes eventually fail, oftentimes sending the value of precious metals to infinity. Will it happen again this time around? Stay tuned for the discussion. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the Market Weatherman Report. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals exchanges this week, thanks in part to dollar sluggishness. Traders viewed dovish comments from the Fed chair nominee, Dr. Janet Yellen, as an indication that further monetary stimulus would be forthcoming. The news stopped the dollar rally in its tracks, putting support under the precious metals. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold shed $35, ending the trading session at $1,290. Silver declined by roughly 73 cents, finishing at 2078. Gold and silver are no longer backdated. The top story moving the markets this week was testimony on Thursday by the soon-to-be-appointed Fed chairwoman, Dr. Janet Yellen, before the Senate Banking Committee in Washington. Dr. Yellen will take over at the Fed next year. She noted that the U.S. economy and job market are performing short of potential and that the Fed's economic stimulus would continue. It sent the gold bears scrambling to cover their short bets against the yellow metal. Dr. Yellen also noted that the domestic economy is showing signs of improvement. Nevertheless, inflation and unemployment are outside their target levels, leaving ample room for further stimulus efforts. In related news, economic reports continue to support further Fed stimulus operations. The Federal Reserve noted the Empire State General Business Conditions Index declined in November, the first such decline since July. It promptly capped the dollar, sending the greenback lower and gold higher, on expectations of further stimulus. Meanwhile, China has officially ascended to superpower gold consumer status. The crown of number one gold consumer was passed from India to China this year. China purchased nearly 800 tons of gold compared to India's 715 tons. That's according to the World Gold Council. China's middle class apparently has a voracious appetite for the metal, a sizable population of now approaching 1.5 billion people in total. As the middle class becomes more affluent, the proportion of income directed into gold investments and jewelry increased substantially by nearly 20%. Demand in India was curtailed due to government-related import restrictions, levies, and taxes designed to support the rupee currency. Almost all of India's gold demand is met by imports, though, purchased in U.S. dollars, whereas China is a major gold producer. Elsewhere, according to SEC filings for the third quarter, billionaire hedge fund manager John Paulson maintained his stake in the Spider Gold Trust, world's biggest gold-backed exchange-traded fund. Paulson & Company noted in a report that the risk of high inflation is the top reason they're holding on to gold as a long-term investment. In addition, formerly bearish on gold, fellow billionaire investor George Soros increased his position in the metal. In the third quarter, Soros Fund Management bought 1.1 million shares of the Market Vectors Gold Miners ETF. Bottom line on precious metals. Analysts at investment bank Barclays are maintaining their $13.25 gold price target for the fourth quarter, and the U.S. Mint reported this week that sales of American Eagle's 1 ounce silver bullion coins reached an annual record. For the rest of this report, plus next week's stock picks, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange for the sixth consecutive week. The Dow Jones Industrials recorded yet another new all-time record close, ending with an earshot of 16,000. Investors were encouraged by dovish comments from the soon-to-be-appointed Fed chair. By Friday's closing bell in the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones Industrials added about 200 points, 1.27%, finishing at 15,961. The S&P 500 added 28 points, ending at 1798, while the NASDAQ added 66, 1.7% for the week, ending at 3985. Meanwhile, George Soros apparently is loading the boat with shares of Microsoft and FedEx Corp, while cutting his S&P put hedges, according to recent filings. Investors shared his bullish sentiments on stocks, which Warren Buffett is also increasing his position in oil company ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil is a member of the Dow. It climbed about $2, or 2.2%, to $95.27. 2013 is on track to post the best performance in 10 years for stocks. One source suggested the S&P 500 index is slightly undervalued, with the current P.E. ratio of roughly 15 compared to the traditional 16.2 P.E. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, according to the 7-component fear index, greed is now approaching quite frothy levels. Now, this is a bearish development, but it's not a timing mechanism. Price technicals are much more adequate for spotting market turning points, so you'll want to be sure to log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account for next week's forecasts and all of the stock picks. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Dr. Ron Paul, Jim Rogers, and Mike Maloney. So we want you to stay with us here. Well, Michael Maloney is the founder and owner of GoldSilver.com, a global leader in gold and silver sales. Author of the best-selling precious metals investment book of all time, it's a pleasure to welcome Michael Maloney.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back, and let's begin, if we could, with fiat currencies. You say all paper money schemes eventually end in the same fashion, collapse and inflation. I wonder if you could please tell us why you expect the U.S. dollar perhaps to follow in, the steps of its predecessors.
Well, there are some fiat currencies that were just basically abandoned, but when that happens also, it still goes to pretty much infinity price for everything. So they all go to zero. That's a fact. But not all of them end in hyperinflation. But we've tried this hundreds of times throughout history where we expand the currency supplies to stimulate growth. And what it does is distorts the economy, creates a wealth transfer, and ends up causing a lot of pain in the end. It always ends in disaster. There isn't a single example in all of history of this working out.
You know, not a single incident in history where this essentially ended well, particularly for the hoi polloi, you know, for the bourgeois, for the everyday folks. I mean, we essentially get caught holding the fiat currency bag.
Exactly. The distortion of the economy. See, when you create a new unit of currency, it doesn't actually contain any economic energy. It's neutral, basically sterile. Somebody spends it into circulation, and what it does is rob purchasing power from all the other sectors of the economy. So it pushes one sector into a bubble while it's causing prices to rise in other sectors, meaning people confuse rising prices with gains. It's actually a loss in purchasing power of the currency. So, when an asset class rises very fast, that's inflation. You get inflation of real estate. You know, one of the things, every dollar goes somewhere. And when they talk about the CPI index and things like that, when they talk about inflation, I like to use the, Milton Friedman's definition of inflation. It's an expansion or a contraction of the currency supply as inflation and deflation. Every dollar goes somewhere. So whenever they create excess currency, it inflates something. It's just that there's different waves and cycles, and currency takes the path of least resistance always, the place where it's going to get the most gains. It either inflates the stock markets, or it inflates savings accounts, or it inflates retail prices. But whenever they create currency, it does create inflation. And one of the things that people don't realize, we do not use money. We use currency. There is no country on the planet that uses money currently. My first episode of Hidden Secrets of Money is all about the difference between currency and money. And basically, Currency has to be a medium of exchange, a unit of account. It's got to be portable, durable, divisible, something called fungible, where the units are all interchangeable. If I borrow a 20 from you, I can pay you back a 10, a 5, and 5 ones, and you're happy. So that interchangeability is fungibility. Money has to be all of those things plus a store of value. And so people need to stop calling the stuff in their wallet money. We don't have a money supply. We have a credit supply and a currency supply. And these definitions are extremely important.
Particularly appreciate the nuance of real money in circulation. You know, I think that we forget as Americans that for, let's say, 100 years, we actually still had the remnants of real money in circulation. Even up until, let's say, just a few years ago, one could find silver dimes, quarters, halves.
Real money is the enemy of fiat currency. It can destroy a fiat currency and cause the fiat currency to go to zero. So politicians always have to pass some sort of law if they want to get away with spending fiat currency and being able to make promises that they can't afford to keep without imposing the inflation tax on us, a stealth tax that the public doesn't see. If they want to promise all this, these free goodies that aren't really free, they have to pass some sort of laws to get rid of real money. You know, fiat currency, like I said, it distorts the economy, it causes bubbles. So for the savvy investor that sort of knows what's going on and the people that are good with playing with credit and so on, it's a benefit. They win at everybody else's expense. Like I said, the inflation tax, I was interviewing Steve Forbes a few months ago. One of the things he brought up that I'd never even thought of before was who made the Federal Reserve the fourth branch of government? Who allowed them the power to impose they're targeting 2 or 3% inflation. That is their target. In other words, they're saying they're going to impose a 2 or 3% tax across the board for everybody in the United States. That's a power that the government is only supposed to have.
No, it sure is. And, you know, if we look back over its 100-year tenure beginning in 1913, most sources indicate that we have lost roughly 96% of the purchasing power of the greenback over that 100-year period. Here at its centennial birthday, if you will, facing a runaway balance sheet at the Federal Reserve, approaching $4 trillion, on track for $5 trillion as soon as this time next year.
I keep on harping on this in different interviews and stuff, but basically the public does not understand the scale of the emergency that is going on. You know, they did all these bailouts back in 2008, but then they never stopped increasing the currency supply and doing emergency measures. They're right now creating $85 billion per month. So that equals just over $1 trillion per year. Well, in 2008, base money, I call it base currency because it's not money. So the base currency supply was 0.8 trillion. It was less than a trillion. Now they create $1 trillion every year. In other words, it took 200 years, over 200 years, to produce that first 0.8 trillion of the paper dollars that are in your wallet. They produce more than that every single year, and it's just going, this is QE to infinity. When Ben Bernanke came out and said that they weren't going to taper, that was the point where it was all over with. That was an admission that they can never taper. If they can't start to taper off of this life support without crashing the stock market and the economy in 4 years into an economic expansion, then it's just not possible. And every 4 to 5 years, there's a recession. So we're due for a recession in 2014, 2015 at the latest. And what's going to happen then? Janet Yellen will start producing half a trillion a month, a trillion a month, who knows? Basically, the dollar is toast eventually. One of the things that I show in the second episode of Hidden Secrets of Money is that every 30 to 40 years, the world has an entirely different monetary system. It didn't affect the common person on the last transitions. It will during this transition. But before World War I, we had full gold backing. Between the wars, we had partial gold backing and partial debt backing of currencies. Then from 1944 to 1971, we had the Bretton Woods system where other countries held U.S. dollars in reserve, and then the U.S. dollar was convertible into gold, and foreign central banks only could change their dollars into gold at the New York Fed. And then Nixon closed the gold window in 71, and in doing so, he unwittingly began an experiment that has been proven just hundreds and hundreds of times throughout history to not work. It's always a 100% failure rate. Nixon put the entire world on fiat currencies simultaneously because they were all pegged to gold, but through the U.S. dollar. So when he severed that tie with the U.S. dollar and gold, he severed the tie between all world currencies and gold. And so we began this experiment that, like I said, has throughout history, there is no example of it ever working. It's 100% failure rate.
Now we become accustomed to this QE to infinity, and what we haven't even addressed, the Fed funds rate and overnight lending rate, virtually at zero.
Right. What it means is that they're out of ammunition. What they're doing isn't working. And so when we start to go into a recession, and we really are in one, we never got out of the last one, but when things start getting worse, they're going to triple what doesn't work, and then they're going to quadruple what doesn't work. They're just going to keep on saying, well, since it didn't work, we need to do more of it. And basically, this is the beginning. 2008 was the beginning of the transition to the next monetary system. If you look around the world, my series, Hidden Secrets of Money, and you can see it at hiddensecretsofmoney.com, it shows all of the nails in the coffin for the U.S. dollar standard. Since 71, the world, you know, it was a whole bunch of fortunate accidents for the United States that put us on this global dollar standard where we're the world's reserve currency. We didn't have any wars on our soil, and during World War I and World War II, countries paid us in gold, and by the end of World War II, the U.S. had two-thirds of all the world's gold and three-quarters of all the world's monetary gold, the central bank gold. And so it made us, it's all financial. We became a superpower because of what went on financially behind the scenes of all this war. It wasn't really the war itself that made us the superpower. It was the fact that we had these lucky accidents happen to us that gave us the right to impose a tax on the rest of the world since 1944. If the rest of the world has to hold dollars, and more than half the dollars that exist outside the United States, and we create a new dollar and dilute the currency supply and do some deficit spending with that, it gets its purchasing power by robbing it from all the other dollars in existence, including the ones that reside outside the United States. That's a stealth tax that the rest of the world couldn't see. But they're all waking up to it. If you watch Dollar Crisis to Golden Opportunity, the third episode, you'll see all of these nails in the coffin. And when Nixon put us on the dollar standard in 71, there was a calm before the storm where everything worked just fine until Saddam Hussein started selling oil for euros. And then the nails in the coffin are coming more and more and more quickly. And now there's something happening at least once a month or once a week where another country is turning its back on the U.S. dollar and not wanting to use the U.S. dollar in international trade. And that means that someday all those dollars outside the United States, if they don't have a use for them, they're going to start coming home. We already had a picture of what this looks like when that happens. I don't know if you remember the late 80s when Japan was coming over here and buying up downtown Los Angeles and Rockefeller Center and all of the class, huge inflation, where all of the big skyscraper buildings in, you know, the premium stuff doubled in price very, very quickly. That is basically going to be happening again, except this time it's going to be China coming over here and getting rid of their trillions of U.S. dollars that they've got in reserves.
Well, let's transition, if we could, into just what steps investors can take to convert their paper stocks, bonds, and overvalued assets into physical gold and silver investment vehicles. I understand that you prefer physical gold, as do we. Maybe give some tips to folks and whether or not you shun ETFs.
I absolutely do shun ETFs, but first, I believe that the first step for anybody is to get educated before you take action. Know what you're doing before you do it. And so they should listen to more of the episodes of your radio show, listen and watch everything else that they can find that's similar. My series, Hidden Secrets of Money, is a very in-depth series. It's shot in 16 countries. It has animations that we have two full-time animators that animate complex. Our most recent episode, The Greatest Scam in the History of Mankind, shows how the monetary system works and that it's just a giant Ponzi scheme. And it really is the very first time that people can actually see the whole thing and see how the monetary system itself, just having dollars in existence, steals wealth from the working class and transfers it to the financial sector. It went a million views in 3 weeks. So get educated first, and then the next step, I would say, is to buy physical coins and bars, either in your possession or in a storage account at a third-party depository. I don't like banks and safe deposit boxes. They were closed the week of 9/11, and if you had gold, you couldn't get to it. If you had gold at Brinks or some Brinks is not a, they don't fall under any banking regulation. A lot of these depositories are basically independent companies. Brinks calls themselves UPS with guns. They're an armored car service. They've got a depository, and they will store for people. We open accounts for our customers at Brinks. That's a very liquid way of maintaining your own coins and bars. And then the third thing would be stocks. Stocks give you leverage, but you take your gambling money for the mining stocks and so on. When it comes to ETFs, with an ETF, you have a share in a trust that is a custodian for some gold, but you don't own the gold. You don't own the silver in that ETF. You're owning a share in a trust, and you are an unsecured creditor. And so you are the last in line if something happens to that company. So, if something does happen, good luck. And what you're also, with an ETF, you can short them. If somebody is short, that means that there are more owners for each ounce than there are ounces. I mean, it's that simple. When somebody borrows an ounce and sells it into the market, then somebody else buys it. So that person owes that ounce back to the original owner, and somebody else also thinks he owns that same ounce. So an ETF, if you're going to get involved with them, before you do, read their prospectus and their Securities and Exchange 10-K filings very carefully before you do, and read it with a very suspicious eye as to how could these people cheat me. And when you do, you're going to discover some clauses in there that basically make it okay for them to not have all the gold or silver that they basically are going to claim they do. These clauses have little twists. They either give it whatever they're saying. If you read the sentence, it'll have a word or two inserted that either give it no meaning, or it gives it two meanings, or it gives it the exact opposite meaning of what it appears to be.
You know, it's ironic you'd mention that our mutual friend and friend of the show here, Robert Kiyosaki, one of the first things he asks when entering into any business deals, as he said many times here on the show, is how will they cheat me? And that's euphemistically said. He would said it more colorful manner. Also wanted to ask you about the gold on the London Exchange. You know, it's re-entered backwardation second time this year. That's only the fourth time in 20 years, and James Turk, a regular on the show, he believes that this has marked the lows in almost every, for instance, 1999 and 2008, backwardation marked the lows on the yellow metal. Are you following this indicator at all, and do you think it could suggest a nadir for the markets?
I really am only interested in the very long-term trends. I am not a gold bug. I'm not attached to gold and silver in any way. I just believe that gold and silver are in their cycle right now, and when they are doing an accounting of the expansion of the fiat currency supply, which they have done, it's already happened twice in the United States, 1934 and the 1970s. Gold rises to account for the expansion of the fiat currency supply. Well, it's happening again. And during these periods, Things like the Dow Gold Ratio, where you take the points on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, divide it by the price of gold, and you get how many ounces of gold each share of the Dow costs. And what you see, if you do a long-term chart on this, going back 100 years, is that there are times of a tremendous overvaluation for paper assets and undervaluation for gold and silver. Same thing when you take a look at it, real estate versus gold or silver. Regardless of what the price is, I don't really care what the price goes to. I care how much stuff gold and silver is going to buy. If we're in a deflation and the Dow goes down to 3,000 and gold peaks at 6,000, that means it's half an ounce of gold will buy one share of the Dow. If we go into big inflation and the Dow goes to 30,000 but gold goes to 60,000, it means that half an ounce of gold will buy one share of the Dow. And if we go into hyperinflation and the Dow goes to 30 trillion and gold goes to 60 trillion, it means that half an ounce of gold will buy one share of the Dow. So the price is absolutely inconsequential. I'm looking for how much stuff it purchases. And when you measure gold against both real estate and stocks, it has not completed its cycle yet. We are currently around the area of 12 or so. In other words, it takes 12 ounces of gold to buy one share of the Dow. In 1932, it only took two. In 1980, it only took one. Since we're coming off the biggest bubble of paper assets in all of history, and the lowest, you know, the year 2000, 2001, that was the biggest undervaluation for gold. It was the lowest value that gold had ever had in 5,000 years. You have to look at the fact that before 71, all currencies on the planet, or the vast majority of them, were somehow connected to gold. There may have been one or two that weren't, but those fail, as we know. At any given time back then, there might have been one or two where they go off of gold and then it eventually implodes. But typically, before 71, currencies were always connected to gold, or gold was our money. And then from 1971, so it's only the past 40 years or so, that the world has done this experiment where no nation on planet uses gold as money. So there's no monetary demand in the year 2000. And gold had gone into a bubble in 1980 and entered a brutal bear market from 1980 to 2000. By the mid-1990s, investors just started giving up on gold and silver and selling. And so by the year 2000, nobody wanted gold. And when I discovered gold and silver in 2002 and started buying and started telling everybody about it, they'd be going, gold is the worst investment you could buy. And I'm trying to get them to buy gold in the low 300s. I was buying at 315 and so on, saying gold has been going down for 20 years. And I'm going, exactly, it's been going down for 20 years. Don't you get it? And so it was almost impossible to get somebody to buy gold back then. But it's definitely not done with its cycle. We are just, this pullback that we've been in for the last couple of years is simply the equivalent of the 1975 pullback in gold, where it went from just under $200 an ounce to $100 an ounce in a 20-month period from the first day of 75 until September of 76. It did a big pullback then. So it's a cyclical bear market within a secular bull market. And, you know, people were asking me, because I've been saying that this would happen during this bull market for years, they were asking me if the pullback in 2008 was it. And I said, no, there was too much demand. This a cyclical bear has to end with everybody giving up on that investment class. It has to be considered sort of a poison investment class. And you're seeing sentiment in gold right now that's very negative. Now, it could go down some more, but if it hasn't put in the bottoms already, it will very soon, and then it's off to the races. But it may have already put in the bottom. You know, in my book, I covered deflation, inflation, things going pretty much just as they are, hyperinflation, And then my favorite scenario that was a roller coaster, a mixture of all of the above, I said that there would be the threat of deflation, to which the Federal Reserve would overreact and do a big helicopter drop, which they did. That was the bailouts in 2008 and the QEs. That would cause a reflation, and we saw that with the stock markets and real estate. And then there would be a real deflation, a contraction of the currency supply. And if you take a look at what's going on with the credit aggregates right now, you can look at John Williams of ShadowStats has an M3 that he compiles. If you take a look at those measurements of the currency supply, but then realize that base money or base currency is a component. And so to see what's happening in the credit portion of those aggregates, you have to deduct base currency. And when you do, you find that there's this huge collapse in credit going on right now. So we are seeing a deflation happening in the credit aggregates, and Ben Bernanke has been almost exactly offsetting that collapse with the growth in base money, base currency.
Well, as this interview wraps up here, are there any other topics you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Urge them to take a look at Hidden Secrets of Money. I think they will really, really enjoy it. It's a very entertaining approach to economics and monetary history, and makes it sort of fun to learn these things. And basically, that there is something enormous waiting out there for us in the future. The greatest wealth transfer in the history of mankind. For most people, it's going to be a tragedy. But for the people that are smart and learn about this stuff and take action, it's going to be the best thing that ever happened to them, because if it's the greatest wealth transfer in the history of mankind, that means it's the greatest opportunity in the history of mankind. So take this disaster and turn it around into the best thing that ever happened to you.
Well said. And any other contact information for the listeners today?
Goldsilver.com, where we've got news updated every day, and we offer bullion, coins and bullion, and HiddenSecretsOfMoney.com. Thank you.
Jim Rogers is an author and financial commentator and a successful international investor. It's a pleasure to welcome back Jim Rogers in his Singapore office.
I'm delighted to be here, Chris.
Let's start today with the equities market. And your last appearance on the show, equities were at all-time highs. And last Friday, the Dow Jones closed at the highest point in its history. Clearly, the $85 billion a month in debt purchases by the Fed is a major factor here behind the scenes. You say that you own shares, but you're getting nervous that ultimately this could end badly. What do you think?
Well, I know it's going to end badly when it ends. It means it's going to end anytime soon. You know, all the central banks in the world continue to print money. And it's the Japanese debt, they'll print unlimited amounts of money. And Anki said he'll print $1 trillion a year, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's not ending yet, but when it does end, Chris, when it does end, it's going to be a mess for all of us. Because, I mean, the world is flowing on this unbelievable artificial sea of liquidity, which is pretty staggering when you add up the numbers. But when it ends, I don't know when it's going to end. It's not going to be fun.
Do you think that Dr. Bernanke is handing out stimulus in order to provide a grand exit for himself and maybe a nice transition?
Well, no, I know Bernanke's not going to end it because he knows what's going to happen when it ends. So he's not about to end it. And the new lady is very keen on money printing, so she's not going to end it. She's certainly not going to come in and the first thing she does is have a disaster on her hands. So, no, it's going to continue on for a while. I'm not quite sure what's going to end it. It may be that the market eventually will just force them to end it. But even if the market just says, we're not going to take your paper anymore, the market's not going to say that anytime soon. So neither the market nor the central bankers are ready to end this.
You've gone on record recently noting that the Fed is supposed to prevent economic slowdowns. But, you know, according to the Fed's own data, its civilian employment population ratio is near depression levels. You have nearly 100 million Americans who simply aren't working. They're able-bodied and ready to work. Did the Great Recession truly end, or is that just more government hyperbole?
They would aptly point out that, you know, we still have very high unemployment. Even with the fake numbers, we have a high unemployment. And as you penetrate into the real numbers, you point out that unemployment is high. No, it never ended. The stock market ended, but that's because, the stock market went up, but that's because the Nike and the rest of the central banks in the world printed staggering amounts of money. But the real economy has not done nearly as well as the stock market.
You've noted that the next financial crisis is inevitable and could be far worse than even 2008 with the Great Recession. Who do you believe will be the ultimate victors, or will the entire world suffer in the next recession?
Well, America's the largest economy in the world. If America suffers, everybody suffers. Europe has got big problems. Europe as a whole is an even larger economy than America. So, you know, Europe's going to suffer, America's going to suffer, which means the rest of the world will suffer too.
Gold investors have enjoyed 12 consecutive winning years. It's now in a correction mode. Are you still watching for a 50% retracement from the 1900 peak, similar to what the Goldman Sachs crowd is calling for, about $1,000 on the precious metal?
Well, I don't know if there'll be a 50% correction. I do know that 50% corrections are normal. That's what happens at all markets. It's not unusual at all. So I suspect we might have a 50% correction before it's over. But that's not a prediction. I suspect it will happen, but I'm not buying. I'm certainly not buying at the moment. I think there'll be another chance to buy gold in the future, so I'm not buying at the moment. Whether it goes that 50% or not, I don't know. If it does go that high, I hope I'm smart enough to buy more.
You've also noted that when food shortages occur, war inevitably breaks out. When a major power starts to decline, the burgeoning nations vie for power. Is the stage being set here for another world war?
Oh, yeah, well, yes, that doesn't mean it has to happen anytime soon, Chris. No, we're certainly setting the stage for another war. America's going deeper and deeper into debt, and it's certainly, if nothing else, a struggling power. With China on the rise, there's going to be some kind of conflict somewhere, but it may not happen for decades. It doesn't have to happen anytime soon. But it's certainly going to happen. Unfortunately, we have not outlawed war at all. War's been around for thousands of years, and I wish we could outlaw it, but I'm afraid we cannot.
You know, the U.S. dollar has been suffering in recent months. Some folks are calling for perhaps a retest of the all-time lows on the greenback. Do you concur with this notion? And if so, what do you think it could mean for the markets?
I expect more currency turmoil in the future, and I suspect people will go to the U.S. dollar when there's currency turmoil because they don't know what else to do. I actually own U.S. dollar at the moment, and I don't have any confidence in the long-term future. The U.S. dollar is going to disappear in the long term, but in the meantime, I own it because I expect more currency turmoil coming, and people will flee to the dollar, rightly or wrongly. Wrongly, in my view, but that's what they're going to do. So I own the dollar as a result. But, Chris, you're exactly right. Longer term, the dollar is going to, it's going to disappear. We're printing it as fast as we can. We're debasing it. All paper money is being debased, but especially the U.S. dollar. And America's the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. This cannot continue. Never has in history, anyway.
As we wrap up here today, I wonder if you could tell folks what you're watching for. You tend to be several months ahead of the curve here.
Probably the most important thing going on in the world right now is in China. The Chinese government is having its big meeting. It's a plenary session, as they call it. And they're going to announce what they're going to do in the Chinese economy for the next 10, 20, 30 years. In 1978, this conference led to Deng Xiaoping opening the Chinese economy, which has certainly been the most important thing in the last 35 years. 1993, they had another one, had gigantic consequences. They say that this was going to be as important as the one in 1978 and 1993. I obviously have no clue what they're going to do, but I'm watching it very closely, Chris, because whatever they do, it's going to send a signal to some industries. Some industries are going to receive a lot of money and a lot of incentives when the Chinese decide what to do, and that's going to have a big effect on various companies, various stocks, China and outside of China. So I'm watching carefully. I hope we'll know by the end of the week or early next week. It's going to be it's going to be more important than whatever the central banks do in the world are certainly going to be more important for some industries than even what the central banks do. So keep an eye on China.
Jim Rogers, we want to thank you so much today for taking time from your busy schedule for us.
My pleasure, Chris. Anytime. Thank you.
My next guest requires no introduction. For decades as a congressman on Capitol Hill, Dr. Ron Paul battled for individual liberties and rights. He's now continuing the struggle with the pen and the microphone with his latest book and radio show. Welcome, Dr. Paul.
Well, thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
In your latest Freedom Report, you say that news of the next chairman of the Federal Reserve System has received high praise from Wall Street. But in reality, it really doesn't matter who maybe takes over at the helm. The $85 billion money printing spree per month will continue, with the Fed balance sheet now approaching $4 trillion, on track for $5 trillion as soon as this time next year.
Well, my point was that things will continue, whether you change the chairman or not. I poked fun at him and said that my choice for the Fed chairman was NODA. That is, none of the above, because I don't like the Fed and doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But there have been others that point out that maybe there is a little bit different between Summers and Yellen. If it is, it only means that Yellen is a more likely to inflate and print more money than Summers might have had, if there is such a thing as printing more than $85 billion a month. But I suspect that she is going to pursue the same silly arguments about monetary easing. We'll continue it. She certainly won't slow it up. She's going to make it probably worse.
A frightening thought. And you also point out that by continually printing money, the Fed tampers with the natural rhythm of the economic cycle. That's what economist Joseph Schumpeter referred to as creative destruction. A simple analogy, I think, is a controlled forest fire where rangers deliberately burn undergrowth to prevent a full-scale blaze. Similarly, without allowing credit to contract, businesses to fail, inevitably this economic landscape could become a raging inferno.
What seems to be a benefit is actually a hindrance. They say, well, we kept it from getting worse, but no, they've just delayed the inevitable and made the problem that much greater. What seems so strange to me, at least from the free market viewpoint, is that we're asking for a correction. We think when the Federal Reserve and Congress distorts things, and they work together, they spend too much money and the Fed accommodates, that when it gets grossly out of whack, we should get it back in order. So they're always fighting the market. The market wants the correction. So it's a shame that correction has such a bad name to it, because nobody wants to correct it. Correction should be a good thing. If I'm taking care of a patient and they're doing something wrong, I want to correct it, even though it may bother that individual maybe to eat less or exercise more. In the marketplace, they don't want to have the correction, because politically it's not acceptable, you know, to actually be frugal or spend less or save money and work harder. That's not acceptable these days. Everybody believes that you can create wealth out of a printing press. And in some ways, we in this country have been able to get away with this because we have been very wealthy. We're very powerful militarily. We've had the reserve currency of the world. But I think it's all deception. And the longer it goes on, the greater the danger.
You know, I think it's a great point. By exporting our inflation through essentially printing of dollars as the reserve currency and the petrodollar, scenario there. We really have had this amazing luxury for 30, 40 years where profligacy was acceptable and personal responsibility was just less appropriate. But I think that's changing. There's a sea change headed this way.
If there wasn't a change, it would mean that Americans wouldn't have to work because, you know, we could just print the money and everybody would accept it. But we know that's not the case, and we know there are subtle changes right now. You know, they're not gobbling up mortgage debt anymore, and the Fed has the responsibility to buy most of it, most treasury debt and mortgage debt. So it's slowly changing. And I was just looking today at, the interest rates, and I really think the bond markets have taken a change, and interest rates have started up, although slowly. And that'll be a big event, you know, if rates keep creeping up and then people get very worried about the lasting value of a bond, and nobody buys them, and people realize what's going on, we're going to see higher interest rates, and the Fed won't have, right now, they have some type of control over it. You know, they can manipulate interest rates. When things are going, they can lower rates, make rates lower than people anticipate. But eventually, they'll lose that, and I think we may be approaching that time.
You know, in a recent article, you discussed the new government concept of chained CPI. That's to measure the effect of inflation on people's standards of living. And essentially, the process involves substitution, where higher prices just aren't such a big problem when you can simply substitute a healthy meal with a greasy meal at a fast food restaurant. You say that this is a sleight of hand designed to trick the everyday folks, we the people, by claiming prices are low. Social Security payments are much lower. That helps out the government. You know, instead of letting them eat cake, perhaps the new slogan should be let them eat hamburgers.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, this is not something brand new for governments. I think governments have lied and deceived us in many ways. They certainly have done that in the monetary system. Just look at how long they lied to us about the true conversion value of the dollar in gold. You know, for many, many years, they were able to say, well, the dollar's as good as gold, and it's at $35 an ounce. And they did that for decades. And the psychology, was able to go along with it, you know, after World War II. But finally, those who predicted in the 60s that would break down, they surely did. But they will deceive and lie and try to fudge no matter what they do. But eventually, you know, the truth comes out, because I speak a lot around the country, and a lot of, you know, even during the time I was in the presidential campaign, the audience, especially the elderly in the audience, they knew that the prices were going up more than 1.8%. And that's just there to deceive the people that the QE can continue and it's not harmful. And on the short run, they fool people. On the long run, they can't.
You know, after 12 consecutive winning years, gold continues to struggle this year. But one wonders just how long this trend can persist. The much maligned digital currency, Bitcoin, crossed $400. If digital money, you know, this intangible money, can soar 100-fold in just a few months as an alternative to this crumbling fiat currency system, how high will real tangible money like gold and silver fly when the fiat money loses its global stranglehold?
It's going to go up a lot. I don't think anybody can predict the exact amount, and it depends on what happens when it starts going up. But when you think not too many years ago it was $200, went up as much as $800, and it's still very, very high, that's a high percentage increase. So it depends on what we do. If we straighten up our act, maybe they can get under control. But if not, so often what happens, you know, all they can do is print the money, and they think we're immune from that. But if we get in that, then it's infinity. You know, everybody gets out of the dollar rather quickly. What they don't realize is how quickly that can go. The end stages go very, very rapidly. Greenspan, in his new book, made the comment. He says, I talked to so-and-so, and everybody was looking at it, and these were real experts, and nobody knew there was a crisis coming. And I thought, well, he didn't talk to some hard money people. He didn't talk to the free market economists, because there were plenty. There wasn't just one or two of us out there talking about it. But that's what his argument is. Nobody could conceivably know this, and it didn't have anything to do with the monetary system.
You know, the debt ceiling and government shutdown set a dangerous precedent recently. Few Americans, I think, understand that the debt limit was not actually reestablished. It was delayed until the new year, and there is currently no limit on the national debt. And I'd like to know what you think this portends for us.
I think this is one of the biggest events and the biggest issue that came out of that closing down of the government. Because in theory, it's no limits up until February 15th. Of course, they were making up for past debt increases because they sort of nominally froze the debt, but they were still spending it. So they've caught up with it, and it's added $800 billion, and they're going to keep doing it, and they'll add on plenty. But the whole thing is, on February 15th, you don't go back to automatic controls. The Congress has to act. The Congress has to pass a law to reclaim their authority. And if the president vetoes the bill, you know, to reclaim the congressional authority over the deficit, the bill doesn't pass, and then you'd have to override it. So essentially, it's been canceled. So we may never see a debt limit return. Now, that should be, of course, frightening to the markets. That should, scare a few people. It should be very, very strong for gold. But we do know that events don't immediately translate into price changes and stock markets. It takes time, and there's a lot of mob psychology in there. But when the time comes, if these events are delayed, then they're more, they're of greater consequence when they do hit. They can delay it, but then it comes and it's excessive.
Well, you know, it really was a wake-up call to one agency. China's top debt ratings agency, you may have read, recently downgraded the U.S. Treasury from A to A-. And now that I think that this traditional risk-free investment is no longer, as you might say, risk-free, one wonders how long it's going to be before investors wake up to the only truly risk-free investments, gold and silver.
Well, it's I'm sure, there's a lot of people been selling gold, and gold prices are down, but there's also a lot of people buying gold. So I'm just wondering if somebody studies those international statistics, it just may well be the Chinese that's buying that up, and there's evidence that is happening. They mine a lot of gold, and they even import gold, so they're saving it. I think they're going to be an economic power. And of course, there's a lot of Chinese bashing in Washington. It was very popular to blame the Chinese. They're not the greatest free market country in the world, but to blame them for our problems and saying, well, they want to be labeled currency manipulator. Well, what are we? That's what the Fed's job is, to manipulate the currency. But there's a lot of people in Congress would like to blame the Chinese, but I think they're speaking out, and I think most of us know where they stand, and I think they are in the business of accumulating gold, and when everybody discovers that, then you're going to see a sudden turnaround.
Well, I'd liken it to IBM bashing that upstart Microsoft about 15, 20 years ago. It was inevitable. If IBM, i.e. the U.S. government, had perhaps taken their cue from the upstart, maybe they could have sidestepped a lot of economic carnage down the road. I also wanted to ask your thoughts on the growing trend of gold repatriation. Now, this is an interesting story here. Several European countries started the trend of demanding their leased and stored gold back from Fort Knox, New York, and London. And the idea seems to be gaining some momentum. Mexico and Venezuela also made similar requests. Venezuela got all their gold back before Hugo Chavez's untimely death there. And your adopted state of Texas asked the Fed for its gold reserves. Any thoughts here?
Yeah, I think it's a sign of the times. I think it's very, very important, but I don't think it's yet been discounted to the market. Most people are ignoring it, but those of us who have noticed what's going on, I think that we're going to be on the right side of that, because the fact that we didn't give Germany their gold back when they asked for it, it might take 7 years to get it, that should be a huge event. And yet, nothing really happened. Then it raises the question of what does the federal government actually hold? What's at Fort Knox? What does the Federal Reserve have? And they never permit a true audit. So I'd like to say to them what they say to so many of us: if you don't have anything to hide, why can't we investigate what you're doing. But the one big difference is they have no right to know what we're doing. We have every obligation to know what they're doing and tell us what they have in the bank.
Well said. You know, another disturbing theme as we wrap up here affecting investors today is the threat of bail-ins. You know, governments, institutions are including stealthy clauses in the paperwork that redefines, I think, financial confiscation. Should Americans be concerned of a Cyprus-like or maybe MF Global-like rehypothecation or confiscation scenario?
Well, I think so. I don't think we're on the verge of that, but that's the trend of countries. They will confiscate. They'll make you buy certain things, or they'll take your pension funds. That is commonplace. They'll have capital controls. I think we've seen hints of that. So the government, the state itself, along with the central banks, they will do whatever they believe is in their interest, and they will always say, well, we're doing it for the poor people. And if you believe that, you believe the bailouts helped all the poor people, and the wealthy who were taking advantage of the system, they didn't get any bailouts. So it's part of the system, and we should be prepared for it. And it's, you know, a lot of people don't think about it. They have more other things to worry about, and they don't pay much attention to it. But I think ultimately that will come, and it's probably started to a small degree already.
Any other topics we've missed today that you'd like to comment on?
Well, not in particular, other than the fact I think Washington is totally out of control. The spending is going to continue, and they're going to continue to weaken the dollar. And as far as I'm concerned, looking at the value of the dollar and purchasing power and looking at interest rates are probably the two things that we have to watch carefully to see the big turnaround.
Could you tell folks about your latest book as well as any other online contact information?
The best thing is to go to ronpaulmd.com. I have a new website, webpage for personal information and all the things that I'm doing. And I have a book out on homeschooling. I'm very interested in education long term, whether it's working with the Mises Institute in college age kids studying. But I think also the educational system is in shambles. And the book talks about the mess public schools are in, and offering up a curriculum where people might get a real education.
Well, Dr. Paul, we really appreciate your time today. We know you're very busy, and we want to wish you continued success, sir.
Thank you, Chris.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Assuming reliable jobs data, recently, for the month of September, the number of non-participants in the U.S. labor force rose to a record 90.6 million in September, which is up from 90.47 million in August, which is up from 89.96 million in July, all of which is really up from 80.51 million when Obama took office in January of 2009. Total employment in the U.S. is currently 144.3 million, which means that for every three Americans over the age of 16 earning some kind of paycheck, there are two who aren't even looking for a job. A non-participant in the workforce is defined as someone 16 or older who is unemployed and hasn't looked for a job in the last 4 weeks. So, are people simply giving up on finding a job? Is it that there are just more people receiving government support in one way, shape, or form, like unemployment, food stamps, disability, and soon Obamacare? That is, after they read and absorb the book, Websites for Dummies? We know that demographically there is a falling number of females in the labor force, which has dropped from 59.4% in January of 2009 down to 57.1% today. I believe the answer is simple. Government policy, in action, represents one of two things. Either those policies are wind in your sail or an anchor on your tail, and there's nothing in between. Either those policies and the regulations they represent are good for jobs or they are not. Either those policies and the regulations they represent fuel optimism and innovation, or they don't. The parallels are ominous to the book Atlas Shrugged, where people of ability who could work, who could innovate, who could employ others, systematically stopped working, and for all intents and purposes, went on strike. Why continue to work when the dominating political and intellectual philosophy of the day drains your productive energy and severely curtails your ability to retain the fruits of your labors? Many will opt out of such a system, some by choice, many by necessity, because such a system breeds indecision. It breeds uncertainty and disincentivizes those who would create jobs. It sets the stage for those who want and need jobs to simply give up, which is where we are at today. Given this backdrop, there are still an alarming number of people who believe that everything is going to be okay. They cling to the denial mechanism by refusing to open their eyes and see what is truly happening around them, to their families, to their friends, and even to themselves. They say the government won't let the market crash, or the government won't let the price of gold get too high, or the government won't let gasoline get to $5 or $10 a gallon. Built into the very premise of this kind of belief system is a subconscious understanding that the stock market, the gold market, the energy market, and by inference that all markets are manipulated. And the government will somehow manipulate or manage those markets for our benefit. So, how do you think they're doing so far? And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.